Hi, and welcome back to the PHNN Institutional Podcast, where we discuss issues that are top of mind for institutional investors. I'm your host, Julie Ducharme, and I'm a portfolio manager on the institutional team. And today we're going to be pulling back the curtain on the challenges facing global equity investors in light of the fact that, the backdrop just keeps shifting the balance of power around the world. And I'm delighted to be joined today by my friend and colleague, Habib Subjali, Senior Portfolio Manager and Head of Global Equities at RBC GAM UK out of London. Habib, welcome and thank you for joining me today.
Hi, Julie. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. It's a real honor.
Well, let's get going. And we have so much that we could discuss. And the goal today is to cover a lot of interesting topics, including investing through the different economic environments that are unfolding, navigating some of those shifts in the technology platforms, and then the concentration that's emerging within the largest companies and how to manage all of these risks and arguably opportunities that come with them. So in order to set the stage for how you see the investment landscape unfolding, perhaps you could start by explaining to our listeners a little bit more about your philosophy, you know, how your team invests, your competitive edge, and maybe in a few words, help us understand what you believe is the key to success in managing a best ideas equity portfolio.
Yeah, interesting question, Julie. You know, I think you said this is a philosophic question, right? And our philosophy is very simple. As equity investors, we want to invest in great businesses at attractive valuations. Why great businesses? Because great businesses produce wealth over time. It's not a straight line, but over time, they take capital, human capital, physical capital, financial capital, and they multiply it. And as investors, that's our job, to identify these great wealth-creating businesses, assemble them in a portfolio, and then let that wealth creation accrue to our investors. Now, this is very simple philosophy. It's easy to say, but hard to do. Right? It's identifying these great wealth-creating businesses isn't easy. Historically, our industry has done this by using financial analysis. And if you ask most people in our industry how you identify great investments, it is, you get a series of ratios like, low PE, high EPS growth, or low price to book, high return on invested capital, those kind of financial ratios. But business leaders and entrepreneurs, I've been asking them this question for like 35 years, and I've never got an answer that comes back to do with a financial ratio. It's always to do with their intangible assets and liabilities. It's their sense of purpose. It's their corporate culture. That their culture, they're not afraid to make mistakes and learn from them. Their culture might be very customer-centric, that they delight their customers, that their customers turn into their biggest advocates. It's also a willingness to think like an owner and take a long-term view. And it's these sorts of things, this delighting your customers, innovating, thinking for the long term, being prepared to make mistakes. These are the sorts of contingent assets that define a great business. And then, of course, on the other side, there are businesses that create contingent liabilities, where these are businesses run for the short term, run for short-term financial metrics to meet short-term EPS targets. And, we see this all the time. You see companies cutting R&D or cutting efficiency programs and software developments just to sacrifice them on the altar of short-term EPS targets. Right? We've seen companies fire customer service and R&D employees just to save short-term costs, again, to meet short-term financial targets. And this may be great in the short term, but it does lead to long-term value destruction. Mm-hmm. So I think for us, philosophically, we try and identify these great businesses by trying to find these, what we call these contingent assets, these intangible assets like, reputation and brand and employee engagement, and make sure we don't invest in businesses with contingent liabilities that are slashing and burning to meet short-term targets and going from a series of short-term targets while compromising the long-term future.
Yeah, that and that makes a lot of intuitive sense. You want to avoid companies that are destructing that long-term value, but find the ones that have something special. There's an intangible asset that you can also add to its financial metrics over the long term. I imagine there's more than a few companies out there that meet this criteria, but probably not many. And I know your team builds high conviction portfolios, right? So that balancing act between being selective about this exclusive group of companies that you want to invest in, but also having enough exposure to the countries and the sectors that are available. So how do you construct the portfolio to balance all of this?
Good question. This is something we battle with every day, right? Because, when I talked about our philosophy about investing in great businesses, wealth-creating businesses, that's about identifying individual businesses. Now, we're lucky to say that these great wealth-creating businesses come in many different shapes and sizes. They come in different industries, and they are there in different geographies, different countries. You might have to look for them, and in some places it's harder to find than in others, but they are there. But when you identify these individual businesses and you start assembling them into a portfolio, all sorts of different things start happening. You start getting concentrations by country, by sector, by size, by style, volatility, and so on. And these concentrations can really have a big impact on the returns that the portfolio level returns, that which is the returns that our clients see. And this is where on our team, we're a team of 17 people, but we have four people that are quants, that are three portfolio engineers that are there to help us. And we have seven different risk models. We made an enormous investment over the last 17 years in using in a framework that incorporates these different risk models and creates a dashboard that allows us to, first of all, measure risks, what risks are existing in the portfolio and how those risks are evolving as market volatilities change. Then to help us simulate how we can manage those risks by if we move capital from one holding to another, or if we add a whole new holding, what impact that has on the portfolio. And this helps us then manage those risks so that the portfolio risk is being allocated to the areas where we feel we have skill and which is consistent with our philosophy in those great wealth-creating businesses. And we are trying to control and minimize the amount of risk being allocated to country, sector, size, commodity price, interest rates, exchange rates, all of these kind of factor risks that we don't really profess to have great insights into.
Well, on that, trying to control and mitigate some risks that you have little insight into, I'm curious about the economic environment because, you can't control that risk. Yeah. And so managing, a stable of companies when the foundation of the environment is changing, like if we go back to the pandemic, for example, right? There were certain pockets of the markets that were thriving. We were all cooped up. But no sooner had we come out of the pandemic, we were facing now rising inflation, rising interest rates, this notion of hard versus soft landings, of recessions. And now in the past year, it's this changing political landscape around the world. Those have to be destabilizing for your decision on where to invest, no?
Well, yes and no. I think you have to know what you don't know, right? And you have to you have to know where you don't. Some of these things are binary, right? And why have a portfolio of 35 to 40 stocks when you're making a binary bet? You might as well use a ETF or a geared future or something like that, right? Mm. To make a call on that. And some things like coming out of the pandemic, we've never done that before. Moving from a deflationary environment during the pandemic to an inflationary environment as you came out. Again, we haven't seen anything like that since the 70s, right? So These are very hard to navigate, and all we can do is make sure that the portfolio is hedged, that we have both winners and losers, that these, as far as we're concerned, if we on those dimensions, if we come out flat, we're very happy. At the end of the day, these great wealth creating businesses, as long as that wealth creation is taking place, they're innovating, they're winning more customers, they're taking market share, and they continue to develop and evolve, that is what will make them more valuable over time. It may not accrue in the share price in a straight line, because that does get impacted by the environment and sentiment and all of these factors. But over time, that's what we look for.
And you keep mentioning this word innovation when you talk about the types of companies that that you want to invest in. And innovation over the long term tends to be cyclical, where you have these very momentous environments. And more recently, it appears that one of the biggest decisions investors are faced with is whether or not to believe the hype in the technology sector. And we've seen them before, whether in the past it was the internet boom or cloud computing, in recent history. But now it's all about artificial intelligence or AI. And so, could you talk a little bit about how you think about investing through these kind of shifts or these very exciting periods? And is this time any different for AI?
Yeah, look, I think look, AI is phenomenal. It will leave its mark on our society, on the world, and how you and I live. I have no doubt about that. But in many respects, it is very similar to other technological shifts. Of course, we can go back to things like electricity and the printing press and things like that. But if we just look more recently, everything from sort of televisions to the PC to the invention of the spreadsheet to mobile phones to smartphones. I mean, we have so many different sort of examples of new technologies that have come along. And it always starts the same way. There's a sense of kind of disbelief, oh, this thing will never catch on. And there's been many that haven't, technological shifts that haven't caught on. In the same way, that the blockchain never really achieved its full potential. And do you remember things like 3D TVs and things like that, right? So there, but when things do catch on, there's great excitement around them. And we always underestimate how quickly consumers and users of these technologies adopt them. Initially, there's a lot of excitement around the pioneers who created the technology, whether it was who created spreadsheet technology or who created the cathode ray tube or who created mobile telephony, those engineering companies and the telecom companies. But the pioneers aren't necessarily the ones that make the most value out of it. Like in mobile telephony, a lot of their consumers and their users have made much more value out of it than the network companies. Right? And the same way with spreadsheets, the initial spreadsheets were created by Computer Associates and IBM and companies like that. But Microsoft with Office ended up, sort of dominating that space. And arguably, I think our industry and the rest of the commercial world have got more value out of spreadsheets than Microsoft ever did. And so I think AI will be very similar. Today, the hype is around the enablers and the technology companies and the sort of the hardware stack. And then also where all of this model building and usage is going to take place, which is the hyperscalers, Microsoft, Amazon, companies like that. But sooner or later, the focus is going to shift to the software layer. I mean, essentially, all of this capital spending that is going on, all of this innovation that is going on, and hundreds of billions are being spent every year in enabling AI, that is only justifiable if all of us, You, me, and all these people listening to this podcast actually get some value out of AI. And we need to get value out of AI, first of all, as sort of as corporate users, so that our employers are prepared to pay another $20, $30, $40 a month in software subscriptions and licenses and things like that.
Right.
And also that we all as consumers, as private individuals, are prepared to pay more in terms of subscriptions or prepared to tolerate more advertising revenue because we get value out of this. And this is where I think the focus of AI has to shift. And then one step further than that is going to be how AI impacts the balance of power and the competitive position in different industries. Artificial intelligence has the power to change, you know, the medical industry, both in terms of diagnosis, in terms of reading scans and x-rays, in terms of new drug development, in terms of the efficiency of hospitals. It's going to impact the accounting profession, the legal profession, the architecture profession, the engineering profession. And which software companies, which users, which corporates are able to take this, adapt it, deploy it for maximum value creation, there are going to be an enormous number of winners and losers. I mean, just think what smartphones did, right?
Yeah.
It made certain things like maps and, you know, like certain things completely redundant.
And we can't live without them anymore.
Writing letters made that redundant.
Yeah, and we can't live without them anymore. And I like this idea of being prepared to pay more for AI. And frankly, in some of those great use cases you've described, I think all of us would be happy to see companies pay more for that. However, the investors seem to be prepared to pay more right now for the hyperscalers. And there's a lot of hype around the leaders in AI right now, or at least the perceived leaders today. And these companies are just getting larger and larger as part of the index and are also concentrated in the US. So, you know, we're seeing this extreme concentration happening within the kind of flagship benchmarks that equity investors use globally. You know, is this a bad thing? Or, you know, can we learn lessons from the past and extrapolate on this? Or do you just have to be patient and wait it out until this broader recognition of who's going to benefit from some of the applications of AI will actually manifest themselves?
Yeah, I mean, look, this is something that, well, it's a good thing or a bad thing, I don't know, but it's something that no global investor can ignore. It's something you have to address and you have to manage. These companies did not become the size that they are by accident or by fluke, right? These are truly great businesses. They have innovated in an amazing manner. They have executed. They have loyal customers. They generate billions of dollars in revenues and cash flows. So they deserve to be there at the moment. Now, it is also true to say that no company stays great forever. At some point, they get disrupted or complacency sets in and they get lazy. And you can go back to the history of time and the history of the stock market. And believe me, I've gone back and I've looked at, you know, things like the composition of the Dow 30. You know, the Dow Jones is the America's greatest sort of companies through the rearview mirror, right? And you look at how the Dow constituents have evolved over the last century, and it's remarkable. And I have no doubt that the same thing will happen again. And this is why with these great companies, we have to look for the chinks in the armor and where things are getting, where they're getting stuck in their ways, where they're getting disrupted, where they're not staying nimble enough and they're not cannibalizing themselves.
Yeah. And, you know, this notion that no company stays great forever, it's hard to think about that now when we look at some of the competitive advantages that some of the heavyweights out there have. And I love, you know, kind of this notion that, you know, history may not repeat itself, but it often rhymes. And what better example to take but than Amazon, right? And how their founder, Jeff Bezos, once said that he's often asked, you know, what's going to change in the next 10 years? But he's almost never asked what's going to was not going to change in the next 10 years. And for a company of his magnitude, they probably need to be worried about both of those. But he believes the more important question is the one, you know, what is not going to change in the next 10 years? And so in the context of you as an investor, can you talk about what is as important today as it will be in 10 years to the best of your abilities?
Yeah, look, I come back to that thing about sort of contingent assets and contingent liabilities, right? The hallmark of any business, whether it's in the mining industry, it is in retail, it is in financial services, it's healthcare, it's technology, is how people come together and work as a team, how they play to their different strengths, but that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, that they are prepared to take risks, but not defining risks, how they learn from their mistakes. You cannot innovate without making mistakes, but how you learn from those and how you don't become too bureaucratic and how you don't become complacent once you've had some degree of success. So these things, and also human nature being human nature, you will always have successful companies trying to cut corners, trying to extend their period of dominance by lobbying politicians and cutting corners by taking advantage of their customers or their suppliers or their employees. And this has always happened and will always happen. The tools that they use will change. The settings will change, but at the end of the day, entrepreneurialism, I mean, this is what the stock market is all about, and this is why I love what I do so much, is that we have the privilege to look at all of these entrepreneurs and to see which entrepreneurs will continue to execute and create value and which ones will not. At the end of the day, there is a life cycle. And you know, you can fight that for a while, and the truly great companies stay great for decades. Some stay great for, you know, a few months or years, and that's the privilege of this role, actually, is to find those.
Well, and I can say based on my experience with you, Habib, that you're not just talking the talk, but you walk the walk. Your team has, you know, been known for taking risk, has learned some hard lessons, has had to innovate and not be complacent. If that is, you know, a summary of some of the discussions we've had with our clients, I think those are the key words that not only reflect your investments, but also your own team's work ethic and discipline. So, you know, you're truly amongst the great investors, Habib. It's a pleasure to have had you today to share your thoughts with us. And I think our clients and soon-to-be clients really appreciate hearing your insights. So thank you very much. And we look forward to having you back again in the future.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me, Julie. Really appreciate it.
This content is provided for general information only and does not constitute financial, tax, legal, or accounting advice and should not be relied upon in that regard. Neither PHNN Institutional nor any of its affiliates accepts any liability for loss or damage arising from the use of the information contained in this podcast.